Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 85.
There have been thousands upon thousands of books written to help parents raise their children. Everything from thumb-sucking to classical music in the womb have tried to help the parents figure out the best way to raise their children. This is doubly true in regards to how parents should educate their children. But what is the best educational system to use for your child? What does the Bible tell us about the education of our children? We'll discuss one of these ways today. What is classical education, and is it only for a select few? We will discuss these and other questions today on Theology Simply Profound.
Well, thank you for joining us today on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. I'm Bob Terullo. I serve as pastor here at Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Indian Head Park, Illinois. And joining our discussion today is Rob and Melody McKenzie. Rob is an elder, as you know, here at Westminster, and is also an MDiv student at RTS Orlando. Melody is a principal at Providence Christian Academy in Lansing, Illinois. Welcome both, once again, Rob and Melody McKenzie, to another episode of Theology Simply Profound.
I still haven't broken from that. I keep trying.
Yes. I keep trying. You keep trying, but yeah. There's no reason to.
No, there is. There are lots of reasons, actually. No. Anyway, Melody, welcome back. Welcome back to the show. Glad that you're back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Yeah. Well, Rob, what are we talking about today?
Well, you know, today,
I mean, your intro and everything kind of alludes to it.
Yes. I think if you listened to the first part of the show, instead of having been asleep, you would have heard me talk about the fact that we're going to talk about education.
Education.
And what, I guess I'll throw it back to you. Do we have mandates for educating our children?
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, we don't have anything direct from God saying you must do it in this particular way. But we do have mandates that tell us that parents ought to educate their children, that children must learn from their parents in ways of God, mm-hmm. And the way that God orders his world. I mean, I think those are two very general ways of understanding education about God, the duties that God requires of man, and to summarize our catechism about what the Bible teaches. Right. And then even more generally, broadly, we might say with regard to how God has ordered his creation. So that could be generally, you know, the laws of math, laws of science, you know, the nature around us, how mechanics work, all sorts of different subject matters would then fall in line underneath that. And God's the one who orders those things. So for a Christian, it's, you know, specifically, I mean, it's all from a point of view through the eyes of God's word, which has him at the heart and center of all of those things. So, and I think generally people go to Deuteronomy 6 to see that and how parents are to teach their children the ways of the Lord. But it's more just pervasive throughout the Bible that the parents have a certain authority over their children. And you know, now I'm just talking off the top of my head. I mean, but that authority is what continues to be sort of chipped away at. In the modern world. I mean, it may have been in previous times as well, but I just keep hearing story after story of, you know, parental rights being sort of like, you know, pulled away, whether it be, you know, in Europe or other parts of the world or in different places here too. And, you know, just little hints at less and less of a parental authority over not only someone's education, but, you know, their children generally speaking. But generally, it is the parents and in concert, I'd say the church, who have a certain amount of authority with regard to the bringing up of the children, parents in the church, right? So, yeah, community, the koinonia, the fellowship that we have together. I mean, we call each other brothers and sisters for a reason, because we're a family. And therefore, we call each other's children sons and daughters of ourselves, too. So that even orphans in the church have parents, right, in that general sense. And even those without children, adults, have children in the church, mm-hmm. as well. And so there's this communal, community, family, maybe a better terminology to put it, that where there is a sense, not just on the Lord's Day when we're teaching each other through, say, Sunday school classes, but in our general behavior, our way in which we interact with each other, there's a bringing up together. Now, do specific parents have specific duties and authority over specific children? Yes. Yeah, that's definitely a very, very closely held understanding of how the Bible teaches about parents, husband, wife, and those who they have produced, for lack of a better word, the fruit of their loin, and those who are adopted, right? Mm-hmm. Or those who have been given their charge, whether it be foster kids or something like that. Mm-hmm. That they have very specific duty to have their children educated in a particular way. And that particular way, though, there are options of how that works itself out specifically. And I think, and not to be too controversial, but generally there are three ways that people do that today. Mm-hmm. That would be either homeschooling, public schooling, or what has been called Christian schooling, but homeschooling is obviously Christian schooling as well.
Right.
It's just done within the home or in the Christian context.
Well, how we understand it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. But there is secular homeschooling as well, just as secular private schools. So we might, maybe it's better to call it a private school, public school, homeschool, mm-hmm. but for a Christian, those would be within a Christian context, less so for the public school.
Yeah. I think what the mandate from scripture is that Christian parents are to train up their children and educate them in the ways of the Lord and in with a biblical worldview. And that can be done. And first of all, the parents do have the right to choose which way that's going to be done, how they're going to have their children educated. But there still is that mandate of them putting them into a place or at least shaping their education in such a way that they are being given a biblical worldview. Mm-hmm. Now, if you put your kids into a public school, you're not going to get that. So you're going to have to work very hard you're going to have to be understanding what they're being taught and counteracting some of the secularism. And some different schools are going to have different degrees. So you might have a great public school system that actually, I mean, I've heard of public school systems where most of the teachers in the school are Christian.
Right.
And so the kids come home and it's almost as if they're going to a private Christian school.
Right.
Then, of course, you have other schools that are distinctly not in any way Christian and they're coming home and you have to almost deprogram them. So there's everything in between. Mm-hmm. But still, the responsibility is on the parent to meet that mandate.
Yeah, agreed. And oftentimes, right, I mean, in baptismal vows is where we see that first.
Yeah, I was thinking that that's an important point is that I know one of them is to pray with and for our children. Mm-hmm. But to pray with and for them is one of the vows. And so that's one of the essential qualities that you can say a lot is left up to the parents as far as how this comes out. But there are some things essentially that you must do.
So, yeah, those baptismal vows that I couldn't remember, thankfully, we have the internet to bring it up quickly, is do you promise to teach diligently to your child the principles of our holy Christian faith revealed in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments and summarized in the Confession of Faith and Catechisms of this church, right? So that teaching diligently the Christian faith brings out a sense of the duty of teaching. Because teaching the principles of our holy Christian faith, right? And notice it defines that by the Confession of Faith and Catechism that we believe in. That puts something of a big worldview, if we want to use that word for lack of a better term, or one that we used in our last episode, a full-orbed.
Full-orbed.
Full-orbed. And the whole counsel of God's sense of instruction to our children. So, you know, with my children, they're at home and they're in private school. There's a sense of science is a big part of the education because we love to learn how God has dealing with the world around us. And our children love that too. And that's a great joy to be able to then go on a walk with them or go on a hike with them and to help interact with, you know, the world around us. You know, God made such wonderfully beautiful things. So you began, Rob, and talking about education generally. And I said that there, and you asked me about the parental and the church, and we kind of, we've talked about this a bit. And I said that there's three general ones, but even beyond that, there are different methods, right, of teaching. And you kind of talked about that in your intro, mm-hmm. with regard to one in particular type. And I guess that's what we're chatting about today. So help us out with that.
Right. Well, the thing is, I'm going to bring this over to Melody so you can start talking about the types of education. But Melody, you've had experience in Christian schools or private Christian schools, public schools, and classical Christian schools. And so I think it's given you a good understanding of how they all work. But I know that you prefer classical Christian schools as far as what you want to teach and what you're drawn to as an educator. So now that, and you are, of course, the principal of a classical Christian school. So what is classical Christian education?
Okay, well, if you want a persuasive speech on this or a very succinct, excellently written definition of classical education, I would direct all our listeners to search even online for an essay written by Dorothy L. Sayers. She wrote it back in 1947, and it's called The Lost Tools of Learning. The first half or so of the essay is a persuasive speech on how education needs to be better than it was at that current time. And it rings true today as well. But then the second half is kind of her outlining an idea of here is what if we did education this way, in the way that they did back in classical days? So basically, she's hearkening back to the Greeks and Romans, and then also education up through the Middle Ages. Even through the medieval era, she was saying that this was still that type of education. And so I'll just kind of go through a little bit of what she says there, that mm-hmm. she's saying that you can break education down into various stages where you can gear learning in the best possible way for that stage of the child's development. So the first one is the grammar stage for younger elementary students, younger to middle. The second is the dialectic or logic stage that is for what we would think of as middle school, junior high, even up into ninth grade. And then the third stage is the rhetoric stage that is the older student in the upper grades that we would think of as high school before they go on to college and to other things that they're going to learn or not into a trade or wherever they're going to go. This is the fundamentals of their learning. So the grammar stage is typified in the younger grades by a lot of memorization and jingles, songs. They like to chant and sing and learn lots of information. They like to sort things, classify things, have collections. So you'll see that a lot for those of you who are parents who are probably thinking, oh, yeah, my children do like to do that. So you go with the grain of their learning. That's what classical education is about, is teaching with the grain of like the best way to educate at this time of their development. As you notice, as your children get older, they become more questioning. So in classical education, we call it the dialectic stage. Dorothy Sayers also has little nicknames for each of them. She likes to call it the pert stage.
The pert?
Yes.
Like P-E-R-T?
Pert. Yes, which is, you know, a little bit British there.
Yes.
when your children are questioning you, like, why do we have to do this? I already know this. You know, just a lot of that analyzing what's behind it.
Not the impertinent stage?
So at that stage, you want to go ahead and teach them how to argue properly instead of trying to teach them just mind your parents, do whatever you're told. You know, you'd want to take that natural questioning that they have and gear it in the right direction of they should be questioning things that they see in society and in our world to make sure that they're thinking, learning, believing the things that they ought to believe. So again, you're going with the grain there. And then lastly, the rhetoric stage is typified by this is a time in older children's lives where they're really trying to find out who they are. They've in their minds, they've kind of finished education. They know all this stuff already. They know all this information. But now they're figuring out, how am I going to express myself? How am I going to show the world who I am? How am I going to be independent and different than my family, than my friends? things like that. And so they're trying to express themselves, and you're teaching them how to express themselves in a way that is persuasive and is beautiful, is poetic, in a way so that they can use all the education they've learned to the best possible means in whatever it is that they go on to do with the rest of their lives. So that's, we call that the trivium, because there are those three stages. And that's basically what Dorothy Sayers was saying. And
so basically Dorothy L. Sayers said, education needs help. This would be a great way to do it. And then she went and wrote mystery novels. That's pretty much what she did.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Okay. Pretty right. much.
Now,
yeah.
Now, also, this is on Dorothy L. Sayers. I have the little page of her on right now. She lived into 1957, according to this. So she had another 10 years of life. So this, she's writing this at the end of her career, essentially, or late in life. I'm not sure when her career was. But was she one of the Inklings?
Yes. Good.
Yes, I would say that she would be included, although she was almost a fringe, because even though she came, she almost missed out on, could you call it the glory days of the Inklings?
She is considered an honorary Inkling. She did come to several of the meetings. She was invited by C.S. Lewis.
Okay.
And she would come to several of the meetings, but she never was there when Tolkien was there. Because, I mean, they met a lot, actually. Mm-hmm. But every time she would come, he was off writing or something.
He was doing something else.
Yeah.
Okay. So. I was just curious. I just saw a note saying that she was a part of the group that says Lewis, Williams, Tolkien, Owen, Barfield were a part of.
Yes.
But I didn't know if she was actually considered an
Inkling. Yeah, she's considered in that group.
Okay.
And, of course, to the great intellectual MythCon that we went to last week.
Yes.
Which was actually very intellectual.
An ode to the Inklings, right, you said?
It's part of the Mythopoetic Society actually studies the Inklings. And one of our guest speakers was the curator of the archives for the Wade Museum in Wheaton College. And they have a very large selection on Dorothy L. Sayers as mm-hmm. one of the Inklings.
Okay. And the Wade Museum is what?
It's a museum on Wheaton College campus that actually is dedicated to the study of the Inklings.
There you go. Yeah. Not everyone knows that, Rob.
Okay.
Just so you know. I didn't know it was called the Wade Museum. I know that they have Tolkien's desk.
It's actually called the Wade Center, I should
say. Okay. They have the Tolkien desk. They have the C.S. Lewis's desk. They have the wardrobe inspired the wardrobe of all wardrobes. So, I mean, I've been there as well, but I didn't know what it was called. I just thought it was this place.
Mr. Tumpkins greets you when you walk in, gives you tea. Don't drink
that. That is not true. Don't drink it. Well, just want to lower your expectations. He's not really there. So, with schools having sort of grammar, dialectical, and rhetoric, it sounds like the schools could kind of be identical because they have, three things are supposed to follow, blah, blah, blah. But is that the case? Is it the case that, all schools are sort of going to look the same, sort of big cookie cutter?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'll answer that by talking a little bit about my particular school and then just saying what's the same, what's different. But before I answer that, I'll just say that classical education is a philosophy of how you're going to do education, of how you're going to create this learning in the minds of your children. The methodology of how practically that plays out does look quite different. So if you visit classical schools across the country, you'll see quite a range of different things. You'll see a range of different ways that they bring the methodology into play in mm-hmm. their school. So I'll come back to my school then and start. In the younger grades, you have what Dorothy L. Sayers calls the pre-poly stage. It's kind of cute. She calls the grammar stage. Well, I'll go back to grammar. Grammar is the first of the trivium, and this is lower elementary. Like at our school, it's third through sixth grade is considered mm-hmm. the grammar stage. And I talked about that before, but I didn't really explain the word grammar. In our minds, in modern education, we think of grammar as being English grammar, how you learn a language, right. where you put right. your, how you use pronouns, where you put your punctuation, things like that.
Where you dip your thumb.
Right. The mechanics.
Yeah. The mechanics, yes. And Dorothy Sayers uses the word grammar, and I think in the broader definition of the very fundamental basics of anything you're learning. So this applies even to adults, right? You become an auto mechanic and you need to learn the grammar, the fundamental vocabulary of what are all the parts of an engine called and how are you going to use them? What are your tools called and which tool belongs to which task that you're going to perform? That's the grammar, mm-hmm. the very fundamentals of it. So we're learning the fundamentals of every single subject. So if you read her essay, she spells that out very carefully there. So she calls that the poll parrot stage because she's saying that at that stage, there's a lot of give and take back and forth between the students and teachers. So the teacher will say, here's the order of operations in math, parentheses, exponents, multiply, divide, add, subtract. Then the students would say back, parentheses, exponents, multiply, divide, add, subtract. Then she'd teach them this cute little saying that goes with it. Please excuse my dear Aunt Sally. And it's this cute little fun way to memorize the first letter of each of those, the P-E-M-D-A-S. It's really hard to think of it.
Not that easy, is it?
No, it's not that easy.
Different context.
But the teacher would say it, the students would repeat. So you've mm-hmm. got that poll parrot. That's what she liked to mm-hmm. call it. But, it's just called the grammar stage. You're learning the fundamental tools of how to go on learning and how to do your math in the proper order so you get the right answer. She called the younger grades, the kindergarten through second grade. That's how we do it at my school anyway. She would call that the pre-poly stage, where she's saying, now you're learning the most rudimentary, very fundamental things that you need to know in order to start your education. So you need to know how to read. So you have phonics being taught and things like that. Mm-hmm. So those children are learning how. And it's interesting when you look back at the Greek and Roman society. In Greece, the boys began school at age 9, which is, approximately third grade, ages 8 and 9, they're starting school. And so you see there, that's when the grammar stage would begin, mm-hmm. So that they've already learned things from their moms at home on how to read, how to write, all those fundamental rudimentary tasks. Mm-hmm. And now they come to school ready to actually learn information, mm-hmm. So that's how you'd see that play out. At my school, the dialectic stage is played out in our 7th and 8th grade with the addition of a logic class. So they're actually taught logic as a subject of here is how to think in a proper step-by-step format that gives them a logical way to apply every single other subject they're learning. So mm-hmm. they're learning that methodology that's continued over into every single subject that they have. And then in the rhetoric stage, which most people think of as high school, some people would say it's mostly 10th through 12th grade. That's when you would do a lot of, that's when you'd have like drama entering the picture. You'd have a lot of poetry, not just at the younger grades, you have poetry recitation. But now at those older grades, you're allowing the students and helping them to express themselves in a poetic way so that they can get out all these thoughts and feelings and ideas that they have. Because young people have so much energy and enthusiasm. they're thinking these thoughts for the first time and they're like, yeah, they are young adults, mm-hmm. They're practically ready for the adult world, but they're still under that umbrella of their parents of finishing up that education. And that's why it can be very difficult sometimes in a clash that happens because high schoolers are not little children anymore. They need to have that way to express themselves and to show that they actually have learned a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And they need that last little time while they're still with their parents to be able to express themselves in a way where they're still under that protection and they can do that without, being in the real world and losing their job saying something they shouldn't or something.
Well, protection and guidance.
Yes.
Right? And that.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, parents are meant to be a part of that, training their children to a point where they get wise, they can make wise decisions on their own.
Mm-hmm. So, we've talked about, it's interesting to me with Dorothy L. Sayers when she wrote that, because at this right within the time of the 40s and that, and even a little earlier, and then into the 50s as well, you have this society and a world actually where there's a reaction in one sense to the communism that was taking over of Europe, And also being pushed into the atomic age, this idea of that we can now destroy ourselves. So that's when you started seeing a lot of science fiction, not just books, but also all the movies about how, you know, we talk about the day the Earth stood still or the War of the Worlds, which of course is harkening back to H.G. Wells. But still, there's this doomsday idea. But the reaction to the communism and the taking of the kids to be raised by the state, to be indoctrinated by the state. And so we start seeing the books, Brave New World, and of course, 1984. Animal Farm is probably, I think, the best depiction of that. But even C.S. Lewis in That Hideous Strength, we can see this totalitarianism that's coming about. And that's kind of what Dorothy L. Sayers is kind of also fighting against. It's that pulling away from Christianity, that pulling away from a biblical worldview in education, and how she's saying, no, we need to have that within education. Because we've been talking a lot about the classical part, but within classical Christian schools, there really is this biblical worldview that kind of permeates through it. But one thing that's interesting to me, and I'll turn it back over to you to give the history of this, is that when Dorothy L. Sayers puts this out, and you also had people that were not necessarily looking at like a classical Christian school idea, but you had like Adler that was also talking about the lack of education itself being downgraded. But so you had these people in the 40s and 50s talking about these things, but there wasn't really a fundamental movement that took off at that time in this vein, right? How did we get to where we are now, where we actually have classical Christian schools?
Yeah, I was going to say 1947, 2017.
Right.
What happened in between? Like, was it like, you know, 1950 that there was a first classical Christian school, or 1970, 1980? You know, did anything happen? I mean, did this just fall on deaf ears or get lost in the trash bin of history?
Well, it's pretty interesting. Even Dorothy L. Sayers gives like a kind of a little tongue-in-cheek joke sort of about that, where she says nobody might read this or know what she's saying or actually do what she's proposing. She was giving these thoughts. And so it's interesting when you jump ahead to the probably late 70s, early 80s, when you have a group of concerned parents getting together, trying to start a school for their children. You know, they've got their children just reaching school age. They're trying to decide what sort of education to give them. And lo and behold, they read and discover Dorothy Sayers' essay. And they say, oh, well, this sounds like a really great idea. She says she doesn't know if anyone would do it. Why don't we just try? And so they did.
We'll show her.
Yeah. And so there you
I'll
have.
I'll take that dare.
There you have Doug Wilson and the other people that helped found Logos School in Moscow, Idaho. You can hear him tell that story. He's told it many, many times throughout the years, but Logos was founded in 1981. And you could really consider them the beginnings of the modern classical education movement, that they're the ones who kind of started it out first. And then other people saw that and thought the same thing about Dorothy Sayers' essay and also started it. And then from there, you have the founding of the Association of Classical Christian Schools and so on. So many, many schools have done that. And that's kind of why, back to the question on do all classical schools look the same? Well, no, because what we're doing is we're going back to her essay, reading it and saying, okay, how is this going to play out? What methodology are we going to use to bring about her philosophy that she proposed?
That's interesting. This is off the top question. You were going back to Dorothy Sayers in 1947, and sort of you're using it as something of a framework that she's providing. But is there literature prior to her that classical Christian schools go to for sort of either inspiration, I'm not sure, or methodology or philosophy to sort of guide you guys in it? Is there something before 1947, before her article? I'm just curious.
Well, there's tons of writings on education that are very well written by many different people. But I would say that when you're talking about the actual idea of the trivium, I would say that's where we would point to.
Okay. All right.
I mean, cool. Of course, she's pointing back to the Greeks and Romans. You can point all the way back there or to the Middle Ages because that's where it came into play. There's practical things we do. I have a review game in my class that's set up in a way that has a Latin name. I can't remember at this very moment, but the name of the game is Latin, and it's something that the teachers in the monasteries used when they were training the boys, their theology and things. They would use this game where there was this back and forth questioning and answering, and they had to give back all their answers of all the things that they had been taught. So she's writing back to that. So there are tons of other writers that have those parts. It's just that I would say that we give her the credit for putting it in this succinct essay format and saying, here's what we're doing.
Yeah. Okay.
Why is Latin essential? Because I think all classical Christian schools are kind of known to teach Latin. Some will teach Greek. Some will teach Hebrew as well, things like that. Other languages, French. Depending on the school, like you said, it's not monolithic. They all can teach different methods. But why is Latin kind of the one staple?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the question of the fact that classical Christian education is a philosophy of why are we doing what we're doing. So why are we teaching Latin? It's because it's one of the absolute best ways to teach you how to think properly, logically, orderly, and so on. There are many other sub reasons, like it gives you a jumping off point for learning other languages. It gives you the framework for using terminology like declensions and conjugations. English is such a different sort of language in that our words don't decline and conjugate as much as other languages do. And so we don't use a lot of that terminology. And so when you go to learn even Spanish, all of a sudden words have gender. And there's no particular rhyme and reason to many of them of, you know, why would a table be either masculine or feminine? Well, many other languages have that and English doesn't. And so Latin gives you that framework for how to learn a language, but more so it teaches you the orderliness of thinking and putting things in the right order. Elementary students, typically classical schools would start Latin maybe in third grade or so. That's where my school starts Latin. The formal Latin instruction. That's one of the prime ages. Dorothy Sayers says teach it as early as possible. That's a prime age where students are really loving playing with words and sounds and how things feel on the tongue. So they like all the little chantings of amo amasamat, amamusamatasamand, and so on.
What was that?
You're speaking in tongues over there, yes, yeah. Literally.
Yes, I was, but it can be interpreted.
Not by us.
Well, can I be my own interpreter?
Sure.
I'm not sure.
In this case, yes.
Studio B? Sure.
Absolutely.
Well, it's just the chant of I love, you love, he, she, it loves, we love, you love, they love. And in English, you'll notice that the word love stayed the same almost all the time, except one of the lines had loves instead of love. So like I said, English does not conjugate hardly at all. But because Latin does and other languages do, it's very helpful for learning. But the students think that they're having fun and doing these chants, and they like going home and saying, Mom and Dad, I can speak in Latin now. Guess what I know? And they go around their house labeling things, you know, labeling the table as a mensa and things. They really enjoy doing stuff like that. It becomes a fun thing for them. And really, the thing about kids is they're curious and they love learning. So it's up to adults not to mess it up. Children love learning. And if we go with that and help them maintain that love of learning, then they'll become lifelong learners.
Well, you know, interesting because now you're sitting here talking in Latin and stuff. And that brings me to an understanding of classical Christian schools. Obviously, only genius children can go to these schools. And only the elite. I think we've heard that. People have said that. Well, you know, I don't want my kid to go to a classical school because you only elite children go there, and you've got to have these super genius children and stuff like that. So is that true?
Well, I could try being as sarcastic as you are.
No, you could try. many have tried.
My school went across the entire country and found all of the most intelligent children in the entire, all of America and beyond.
There you go.
And gathered them together in this town of Lansing. No, I truly believe that classical education is for every child, that any child can succeed and learn, because it's how do you learn? And, you know, anybody who listens to those stages, well, this might be actually a good time to geek out for just a minute here.
wait a minute, just now?
That's what we do.
If you look at what Dorothy Sayers is proposing, you can easily overlay that on Jean Piaget's stages of child development, on how the child develops through their stages of life and how they grow and change and learn. It's very, very similar to the thought there. You can also very easily compare it to Vygotsky's zones of proximal development. That you could just put that hand in glove with classical education. It fits so well that it just, when you hear something from a different standpoint and it rings true, that just gives you more cause to say, oh, this really is an excellent way to do this, you know?
Quick question for you, more on the practical side of things. So say you have parents who have kids who are junior high heading into high school or maybe and high school, and they say, well, there's a classical Christian school there, but, you know, we haven't trained them in Latin. Can they enter into the middle of it or at the end of it, say a high school, and still value without having the precursors of grammar and dialectic?
Yeah, that's a great question. Right. That's one of the obvious ones everybody asks, right? That's excellent. Most schools do want to find a way to bring transfer students in. Mm-hmm. There will be things that the students just don't have, they haven't had, you know, so that if you look at our 7th and 8th grade, for instance, our students are reading a broad variety of works. The students this year are reading Eusebius. Well, if you come into the school and you haven't read that, you're missing something that these students have learned. But it's all about how are you learning? Mm-hmm. So anybody can join that track at any time and just learn. And the prime example I'd give for that is all of us adults who missed out on classical education. Here I am, a teacher in the school and a principal of the school. I did not receive a classical Christian education. I received a Christian education, but it wasn't from the classical methodology or the classical philosophy. But that's okay. You can still come in, learn about it, and mm-hmm. see where to go. And different schools will have different ways to make that happen. If you haven't learned Latin, some of the schools have you come in and audit the course. And that way you're still hearing it. You're participating with your classmates and your peers at your own age, but you're not being graded over something that is way beyond where your years are. Mm-hmm. But you're still sitting and gleaning from that, and you still learn so much that is very tremendously valuable throughout life.
No,
there's
helpful.
Other reasons for Latin too.
Yeah, no, I'm just the stepping in part. I can that, you know, like if they'd be judged based upon not knowing the Latin, mm-hmm. how that would work. That's why I was just curious about that.
What tips would you give to, say, homeschool families, people that there isn't a classical school or a Christian school near them, and or anything viable that they want to send their children to, and they say, well, you know what, we're going to homeschool and we're going to do it well, and we'd like to use some classical stuff. What would you suggest?
Well, there's an excellent book that a lot of homeschool families use called The Well-Trained Mind. It is written by Susan Wise Bauer and Jesse Wise. This book was written in 1999, and these ladies have homeschooled their children, and it's really a very excellently written how-to manual that if you just need something to tell you, this is what it is, here's how to jump in, here's resources, go here to find books, and here's what to do, here's what not to do types of things, that could really give you a good jumping off standpoint. And there's lots of other literature out there. There's tons of websites too. A lot of people nowadays like to look at collaborative sites, groups online, and things like that. And there's also various homeschool groups like Classical Conversations and other things like that, where you can get involved with other moms and see what they're doing. There's just tons of resources out there.
Right. And various curriculums through different publishers. That's probably one of the biggest like hotspots of the, what, since the 90s maybe, of just the increase of resources and publications for not only for homeschoolers that come through the schools themselves too, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay. Well, Melody, we're coming to the close of our episode today, but I want to, before we do close out, are there any other closing thoughts you might have on the subject matter today and classical education, or just maybe education, just generally speaking, as a wonderful educator yourself?
Oh, thank you.
Well, well, you can hear your excitement. I can tell you that.
I am really passionate about what I do. And it's funny because for me, the way that I feel about classical education is very similar to the way that I feel about the OPC, that classical education is not the only philosophy of education out there. There's plenty of other great ways to educate your children. But for me, that's the one that I'm passionate about and I think is excellent and the one that I personally want to be involved in. That's how I feel about the OPC, that there are many excellent Christians out there, many excellent denominations that are very faithful. But for me, the OPC is where I want my efforts and services and membership to be held. That's where I am. And so I think for each one of us, that's what, you know, we each need to be passionate about what we believe in. And then I would just say there's one thing that kind of is in the back of my mind that a lot of people have objections of this is why we don't do that. Sometimes when people hear I'm a principal, they immediately get defensive of, well, I can't put my kids there because it's too expensive, or, you know, things like that. And I wasn't asking you why you didn't. Like, you don't have to feel like that. But the one thing that I would say, just as a question of like, what is the most important thing you've been commanded as a parent? You know, at the beginning, we talked about the command is teach your children diligently. Mm-hmm. And you're not commanded which philosophy to use or which methodology to use, but you're commanded to be faithful. And this reminds me a little bit of the parable of the talents. When the one servant was given one talent, another one was given two, and another one was given five. One way to misread this parable, and one thing that I had thought of in my younger days before I had learned this parable well enough, is you can think to yourself, well, it's a little unfair. If the servant who'd been given one had been given five, then he could have made a better way of it. That is not the point of the parable. The point of the parable is that you are meant to take what God has given you and be faithful with it. Do what God has commanded you to do with what he has given you. So if you're listening to this podcast today saying, well, this is all nice and everything, but it's completely impossible, I could never afford that, don't stop there. Don't just immediately brush off the responsibility of a parent by thinking that you can't afford something. You know, that's more of just a,
well, it's excuses. It's excuses It's not, in one sense, it's not looking to the Lord and saying, Lord, I know that you want me to train my children in a certain way, and here's a way that I think would be a wonderful way to do it. Can you, Lord, help me? Help me to actually, to get my kid into this school or to use this curriculum, or if you're going to homeschool, then to be a diligent, faithful teacher within the home. Mm-hmm. You know, we started out this episode talking about the mandate given to Christian parents, and it is to train up their children in the ways of the Lord, understanding what is true. And it's different parents will do that in different ways. Mm-hmm. And that's perfectly fine, because it is up to the parent to actually train their children. But they need to be able to say at the end of the day, I have done the best that I, like you're talking about the talents, mm-hmm. God has given me such, and I've used that to the best of my ability. And that's all that God is asking of you. And, you know, have I put my children into a situation, whether it's public or homeschool or Christian school, have I put them into a situation where they can thrive in their education in a biblical way? And that's what they need to. Now, that might mean that when they come home from school, that the best school in the area is a public school that is not a very biblical school. But when they're coming home, they're saying, what did you learn today? Well, what is that? What does the Bible say about that? Mm-hmm. And you know, instructing their children how to listen to secular reasoning that is not biblical, and to bring it back into the framework of Scripture. and to say, okay, this is why they said that, but this is what Scripture says. And what a great way for parents to interact with their children, than to be able to do that. But at the end of the day, they have to be able to say, yes, Lord, I was faithful to what you gave me.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was saying, is that your responsibility as a parent is what matters the most. And the Scriptures teach us that God has given us all things that pertain to life and godliness. He's given it to us in our word. And in his word, God would not give you these children if he didn't think that you were the one, the right one, to rear them up in the ways of the Lord. So that is your top responsibility there.
Well, Rob and Melody, thanks so much for this discussion, especially Melody with your expertise in the field of education. Well, once again, thanks for joining us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. We are a podcast of Reform Forum, and you can find us at reformforum.org/programs/TSP. That's where we are at. Theology Simply Profound is a listener-supported podcast through the Reform Forum. Go to reformforum.org/donate to find out how to keep this and other programs going. We do appreciate your support. And also, of course, you want to find out more about the congregation we serve, go to westminsteropc.org and other Chicagoland area churches. You want to go to chicagoreform.org. And don't forget that we have a conference coming up in the beginning of October, the first weekend of October. Go to reformforum.org/conference and you find out about the conference of the Reform Forum, our conference on covenantal apologetics, or apologetics more generally speaking, under the rubric of presuppositionalism. I think we have Scott Oliphant teaching, we have Lane Tipton, and we have Jeff Waddington, I think, and Camden Busey. Those are the primary speakers this year. And so go check that out and see if it's something you want to come along to. All right, Rob, what's up next time on Theology Simply Profound?
Well, next time we're going to talk about why everybody should be cryogenically frozen today. Or, subtitle, how we can live in a world that's getting worse and worse.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.